about the Android representation, because this is the representation that all the Leon wrote, well, to some extent, have one. This is very nice. Is that our goal is to find all the representations of all the Lie algebras. And we found the one already, this guy. We'll talk about this first. And then we'll talk about all the E-reps of this YouTube. Okay, so before we start, we have a disclaimer. We're gonna focus on compact, semi-simple Lie algebras. So the thing is that the other ones have a completely different story of representation theory. So let's focus on this, which of course you see our SU2 belongs to compact semi-simple. You're like, what's compact, what's semi-simple? Compact, there are some crazy math definition, but I find the one I like. So it says, so there is something that says, well, it comes with, if we find some finite representation, then it has a background topology of CM2, and if that space is compact, blah, blah. But this one is what I like. They say all the real parameters, if they fall into a finite interval, we call it a compact. So if it's an angle, 0 to 2 pi, it's compact. If you take to infinity, it's not. I'll take that definition. So our theta follows in some A to B, which are not infinite. Okay, about a semi-simple. So remember, we talk about sub-algebra and then talk about the invariant sub-algebra. So if an algebra is called simple, if it does not have invariant subalgebra. And end up that we can lose the restricted a little bit. The only thing we don't want is no non-trivial, we always have a trivial one, no non-trivial in abelian invariant subalgebra. Okay, so all you can just think there's no U1 there. U1 is our abelian algebra we know. So this is basically the definition says semi-simple. It's built up with the simple ones. Says all the subalgebra is connected to other parts of the algebra. So what we are going to say is restricted to this kind of Lie algebra. And in this sense, we can study all the E-reps today for SU2 and move forward and study all of them. And then we can classify all of them. Okay. So let's start with adjoint representation. So let's first recall what we learned yesterday. After a slightly long derivation, but the steps are straightforward. We expand to linear second order. We compare the coefficient of infinitesimal numbers. Hopefully now you're very good at it because we spent a whole afternoon yesterday doing it. Then we drop this infinitesimal thing. We get this beautiful result, which I'll write many times. The result says, oh, look. We have something called a commutator relationship with a structure constant. And then Ela asked me a very good question. Are these really constants? You did it in some specific representation. You choose some generators. What if I choose a different one? What if I even change my dimension? You did it in M, I decided to do it in 2M. The answer is, this FECBC is truly constant. In particular, it's independent of the generators of your choice, all the representation of your choice, all even more remarkably, does not depend on the dimension M. There is only one thing. You can rescale this. If you just call, let me define my F bar ABC to be some constant overall normalization times my old F ABC. As you can see in this relationship, you can just rescale your generator. Then you get the same algebra. So you can. So what I'm saying is F ABC is constant up to a overall rescaling. There's nothing else we can do. And this is just as a normalization constant, as we'll soon to see why we call it a normalization constant. Okay. So what I want to emphasize is they are constants, and they have the following property. This guy is real, anti-symmetric in first two indices, where are equal signs? Okay, so then they are also satisfy the Jacobi identity, which is really nice. This identity says it's actually a condition. If you find me a bunch of numbers, satisfy this identity, we can build an algebra out of it. Okay. This is very good. So let's try to build our universal representation, the adjoint representation. Let's look at our generators carefully. What are our generators? So let's look at it really carefully in the particular representation. So here, A runs from 1 to N. Let me remind you, N has many meanings. It's the dimension of the group. It's, of course, it says it's the number of generators. It's also called the number of our free real parameter. And M. Well, I and J are matrix indices, so you run from 1 to big M. And M has only one meaning, dimension of a representation. Well, but it's a matrix, so of course it has another meaning. It's a matrix, so it's going to multiply some vector, because we understand matrix as linear operator on some vector space, so this M necessarily means the dimension of the vector space that this matrix acts on. And now we make an interesting observation. What if I set N equals M? What happened? Well, our generators, they are linear independent, because we expanded with a bunch of free parameters. If they are depending on each other, then some of these guys must not be free. So if we want to expand around our N free real parameters, we necessarily get N independent generators. Independent things form a vector space. So let's do the following. We span our generators. And this, we get an n-dimensional vector space. And you said, wait a second. I thought I can use this matrix is act on a dimension M vector space, now is equals to N. So now we have a very interesting choice of vector space. We can choose the generator themselves to form a vector space. And then we use the adjoint representation of the generators to act on this vector space. So we can totally call this vector space some E1, E2 after properly normalized. But they are actually generators. We have N of them. Okay. So this representation is so important. So important. As you encounter many times in a year and the year after. So, what do you know that big T, this guy, is the representation, the adjoint representation of our generator. If you say a big letter T, that means we meant a matrix. If we say a small letter T, well, that's the generators. They can live in wherever they want. We can still represent them in this space. But you can represent them in other space as well. In any space, they are n independent vectors. Thus, we can spin them. So now we ask the following interesting question. We have adjoint representation of one of my generator has index. Well, now we say BC because they all run from 1 to n. Now I want to ask, what if I act this matrix acting? So this is the operator acting a vector space. There must be some results here. So we'll try to answer this question. But first I should tell you, what is this adjoint representation? This adjoint representation, let me write here. Someone claimed that we can just take the matrix element of TA to be minus IFABC by the structure constants themselves. Then they claim these matrices will satisfy this commutator relationship. But that's why we claim this representation is really, really nice. Because, well, we know all the Lie algebra comes with structure constants. Then we can just follow this recipe. We found that one representation for everybody. So everybody is happy. So let's try to prove that by using Jacobi identity, which is hidden here. Okay. So the first step I do is I look at my adjoint representation. And I say, well, if I multiply all these guys by minus I, I'm not losing anything. It's equal to 0 on the other side. I can do whatever I want. So this is what I'm going to do. So now, it looks remotely connected to our adjoint representation. So let's do it. If you look at the first term, it'll become T, B, has index CD. If you look at the second term, you get a T, A, has index D. Now this is very enlightening. We see this is a matrix multiplication. This is good. Okay. Then I decide to jump to this term. Because, see, I sort of know the other one. The other one is TA times TB. And this guy is nicer. This has A here, there's B here. Right? Okay, this guy is nice already. It's TB subscript TE. And this guy is slightly away from what I want. But remember, our structure constant is antisymmetric in the first two indices. So I can just pull a minus sign out and switch this guy to be ACD. And of course, that would become a minus sign. And this part become my TA CD. Ah, this is brilliant. I have TBTA. Subtract TATB. And with this weird term, let me worry about that term later, but I'm already happy. This is the commutator. I just have to think about what I want. So what I want, as I told you already many, many times, is this guy. And if you check the indices, this is actually the guy that's gonna work. And you look, oh, we already have the structure constant there, we have the I there, but then we can combine this minus sign with that guy to switch this guy's index. So this whole thing become IFABD, which is what I want, and that guy change the indices of the first two terms, get a DCE. And this is my TD, with indices CE, which match with the other guys, which is good. And we have this term. Okay. So now we have the commutator of TBTA plus this term equals zero. Okay, just throw the commutator on the other side. Then I get commutator of TATB. Indeed, satisfy the commutator relationship. So it's not a hard calculation at all. You start with Jacobian and they identify some of them as our adjoint representation. We show this works. This is pretty cool. Okay. Any questions so far? Okay. So I think I have many boards. The next thing we're going to do, so remember I asked the question. How do I do this? Yeah, question.
Did you say that the structure constants were independent of the generators you chose?
Right.
If you took some, chose new generators by taking a linear combination of both generators,
right,
you'd get the same structure constant?
Right. Nope.
Okay, that seems weird, but I don't know.
Oh, no. Yeah, no, never mind. That's wrong. I meant no matter for the same generators, you can choose dimension, different representation of dimension of the generator, the structure constant remain constant. If you choose linear, of course, you are changing the base of a vector space, and our generator, as we will see, is the matrix element on that vector space. So if you change the vector space, of course, the operator will change. So yes, let me make that more clear. F ABC is independent of which dimension generators you choose. So, right, you're completely right, because we're going to do SU2 soon, and we're going to go to the different base, the structure constants is not the same. It's not the 1 minus 1, 0 anymore. You're completely right. So I should be more careful. It's independent of which the generators in different dimension, but if within this dimension you just recombine your generators and you get some new structure constant, which is just a similarity transformation of this structure constant. So we'll consider this guy. So if we're in adjoint, we'll consider this guy as matrices. Then if you change the base, what will reflect on your structure constants is to a similarity transformation. So I guess structure constants are constant in the same sense when we define our equivalent representation. They're constant up to a similarity transformation. Thank you. Which and end this overall thing. Okay. Very good. Okay. All right. So that's good. But in order to answer that question, well, I like to act my operator on a basis vector. And I like that vector to be normalized. So the next thing we're going to do is define a scheme of an inner product. So we're just going to define this as the trace of the TATB, now they are adjoint representation matrices, have indices running between 1 and n. So I can multiply these two matrices together, take the trace, and that's what I called the inner product of this two vector. So to be specific, I can write the indices out. This is CD. So it's multiplying by some D E, but we're going to take the trace. So C and E actually the same. So this is what we're going to do. And then, as we just mentioned, we can change our generators as a bunch of linear combinations of our original generators such that we can use similarity transformation Then it's not hard to believe, and Georgia has more rigorous proof in his book, is that in some bases, we can make this guy to be orthogonal. In linear algebra, you also have a Drum-Schmidt method. So if you have a scalar product defined, you can always find a also orthogonal base. And then that's what Georgia did in his book, is he show this is indeed possible. So let's stay with this basis. So now we're going to move in to the orthogonal base. So as Daniel correctly pointed out, now our structure constant might be different from the original ones, but they still represent the same group because they are only related by a similarity transformation. So now we can show the following. Is that, well, let me talk about this a little tiny bit more, is that if you're not simple, then you have lambda equals zero. So we have zero norm, guys. So I feel it's weird. And if you're non-compact, you get a negative norm. Then I feel more, even more weird. So I don't know if all these mechanisms don't work. That's why there's a disclaimer at the first. Let's focus on compact, semi-simple, simple Lie algebra such that I can choose all lambda to be bigger than zero. Question.
How do we choose the lambda? Is it the same for all a and b in that indices?
So apparently you can just do other transformation. You can always rescale your generator such that they are all the same. So they should be like different of all. So they if you look at Georgia's book, at first he does write this guy. So this is not summed. In this particular equation is not a sum. Is what exactly what you said. Is for the first pair of generator, it has a constant. For second pair, it has a constant. Then, similarity transformation will achieve to us is to bring all these numbers to be the same size, but they can't change sign. Because similarity transformation act on both parts, so it can only change these numbers by a positive number. So if you have some negative component, they remain negative. If you're compact, you're always compact.
So in principle, we can set it either 1 or minus 1.
Right. Correct. So these things can be chosen to be 1, minus 1, 0, which here you're non-compact, here you are not simple. So we decide to not consider them. Let's stay with our algebras we define, which is compact, semi-simple, then we can happily choose a universal lambda, which is 1. Which is nice. I like my metric to be Euclidean. Okay, so let's move into this orthogonal basis. Question?
Yeah. So what is the vector T B? I mean T A or T B?
Okay. So what I said is that the T A T B. So remember your Pauli matrices. They are the generator, some generators of SU2, and then you can choose, you can just name the first guy to be your vector E1, to be your first Pauli matrix. Name your second vector to be your second Pauli matrix. Name your third vector to be your third guy. So that's what we meant by TATB. Really, this B is important. T is just saying that it is a vector space formed by the generators, for example, Pauli matrices. But I keep it at small t because you can choose the three-dimensional three matrix. Yes?
Does this work for Poincaré algebra?
Doesn't. That's why I excluded. Because Poincaré is not compact. Yeah. And it's not a simple, but a semi-simple.
Are
they
semi-simple? Translations are the idea.
Oh, right. So, wait. Translations are invariant sub-algebra. But it's not abelian. Oh, it is abelian. It's abelian. Okay, so it's not even semi-simple. Well, okay, it doesn't work for Poincaré because It's not a semi-simple, not a compact, but doesn't work for Lorentz because it's not a compact. Okay. Right, it doesn't work for that. And so there is some conclusion that Poincaré or Lorentz does not have finite unitary non-trivial representation. So that, actually, I can refer you to chapter 3.2 of Peskin and Schroeder. They discuss about these Weyl spinners. And actually, the nice part is he gives you a problem 3.1, trying to connect the Weyl spinner back to Lorentz group. But as we said, I made this disclaimer, so we can forget worrying about the fact that they can be other numbers and happily stick with what? Okay, very good. Let's stick with one. You can also say if it's zero, then the following thing I'm gonna say also doesn't work. At least this proof doesn't work. So what I'm going to claim, if we move into this orthogonal basis, then if we look at our square constant FABC in this basis, it becomes even more powerful. Instead of anti-symmetry in the first two indices, now it's anti-symmetric completely. Question.
Sorry, when you say orthogonal basis, what do you mean?
It means the vector TA,
yep,
the inner product of TA and a different TB is zero. Because delta AB.
Oh, okay, right.
So the thing in the middle is kind of a weird, but if you look at the beginning, I'm doing scalar product of two vectors. And I'm giving you the result. So this is defining a metric.
Right.
This is a metric on this n-dimensional vector space I span from the n generators. And then, as many people helped me to realize, I can choose this to be Euclidean. Euclidean is nice. Let's go with Euclidean. All right. So what I'm going to do, need to show that a compact Lie algebra, like the ones we focus on, it has even nicer properties as you can choose this basis such that your structure constant is completely anti-symmetric. So we're going to show this by, I never know, is this blocking part of the board? No.
Only the.
Oh, okay. So let's move. Okay. So our goal is to show that FABC is completely anti-symmetric. It's nice. I like more symmetric objects. First index is anti-symmetric. It's not simple enough. Okay. So how do we prove that? Well, we know this, as we always do. And as I promised already many, many, many times today. So whenever you say this, you know that we have a Lie group. Okay. So we start with this, and enlightened by our definition of scalar product, we're going to multiply this by TD and take the trace. Of course, I have to do this thing for both sides, to be fair. Okay, very good. Then, we'll do the right-hand side first. I like to do easy things first. Let's just pull this constant out. And this guy is my definition. And as we say, we can choose this to be Euclidean. Well, Euclidean. And then we say this side is just a structure constant. Now let's move to this side. Well, I know it's commutator. I'm just going to expand it. And they all have a D tagging along. And remember, this is a trace. Whenever we take a trace, I hope you have already seen before, is that we have this really, really nice property. We can just cyclic them any way we want. as long as you are in this order, you can put one ahead, put one below, it's fine. Just, it's cyclic. So I'm going to cyclic my matrices. So I'm going to decide to bring this A behind, and then, so they're just moving, and then I will bring this to the last. And I can also bring this D all the way ahead. These are all valid things I can do with traces. So now we found a new commutator jumped into our space. Says it's TB, TD, and TA. Uh-huh. So this is just multiplication by matrix. And this is a commutator. This is the Lie algebra multiplication. This is just matrix multiplication. Okay. But this we know. This is what I talk about all the time. This is our commutator relationship. It says we get an I of BD C TC multiplied by TA. But then we can do the same thing. We can dig this guy out. And then we realize what we're left with, again, is the Euclidean metric. So this one tells me that it's going to be equals I of B, D, A. So what we get is F, A, B, D equals F, B, D, A. But we know the first two is always symmetric, anti-symmetric. So we can switch them. Now we realize, okay, what we achieved is we prove the last two are also anti-symmetric. And of course, with these two properties, you can prove, you switch any of them, they will all be anti-symmetric. So this is very interesting. What we learned is F, A, B, C are completely anti-symmetric if we choose a proper orthogonal basis for compact, semi-simple Lie algebra. Okay. This is going to be very useful soon. So this is the first useful result, is that for compact semi-simple Lie algebra, in the particular orthonormal basis, FABC is completely anti-symmetric. Okay, now, in this space, in this Euclidean basis, it also makes it particularly simple to ask what the question I asked at first. If I use matrices, TA subscript BC, let me not write the subscript. Just use the matrix, the operator acting on my basis. Then my question is, what is this? Because we know this is an operator. This is an n-dimensional vector space. And we happily already assume that we already make them orthonormal. And the idea is that I want to do this in the orthonormal basis is because then I can do this. I can do the trick called the insert identity. So let me insert this identity. Okay. So, but let's recognize this. This is really saying the operator in this particular vector space, and this is really the operator's matrix element is what we define in linear algebra. Like if you forget about everything about a group, this still works. This is how we define a matrix element between two bases. Okay, but wait, we just defined what's this guy. This guy in the adjoint representation is I of ACB. Let's absorb the minus sign using the new discovery that this is completely anti-symmetric. I lost the index. Okay. And now let's absorb everything into the vector, because these are just constant. Linear combination of vectors are still vectors. And if you have seen me written formulas a lot today, you will realize, wait, this is the commutator. This is very interesting. If you act a matrix operator of this generator onto the vector space spanned by generator themselves, we get a commutator as your result. So this will conclude our discussion on adjoint representation. So by adjoint representation, with some restrictions, but it always exists. With some restrictions, it always exists. It's defined by the structure constant. And we can make a basis for them. We can make an orthonormal basis for them. Under this particular basis, if you act a operator on the basis, you get the commutator. Okay, any questions? Okay, so now we're in trouble. Say adjoint representation is nice, everybody has it, but now we're basically living in a vast sea of Lie groups. Each of them has a vast sea of representations, but the hope is not lost. You might have learned this. Oh, B, 1 is our only hope. But you have been lied to. Some of you even think R2, D2 is our only hope. This is just not true. And I lost this. Oh, that's scary. Okay, so the truth is SU2 is our only hope. As we shall say, next class, as long as we understand SU2, we understand all the semi-simple algebra, compact semi-simple algebra. And we can even classify all of them. That's what we're going to do next class. But today, of course, we need to understand SU2 first. Okay, to be fair, I should have written as thus. It's very hard to tell on the board. But if you look at the notes, the algebra is supposed to be in a very small, squeezed letter. Shouldn't be this big. But anyway, remember SU2 is very important. So, now our noble goal is to study all the representation of this semi-simple algebras. And this famous formula again. Oh, I hope you will never forget this formula. Okay. So let's start with the simplest. Simplest Lie algebra, which is U1. Okay, U1 is abelian. I can just use EI theta to represent them. And then there's not much I can say about them. Let's move to the first non-trivial algebra that has some structure constants. So, what would that be? Let's enlighten by the fact that the FABC is completely anti-symmetric for the Lie algebra we are interested in. So what do you think? It has 3 indices, and we want it to be completely anti-symmetric. So what do you know that it have that property? Very good. Levi-Civita? Because every time I pronounce it, I have to ask Dan first. It's too long. Okay, this guy, which is 1, if it's 1, if it's an even permutation. If it's 0, if it's -1, if it's an odd permutation, and a 0 otherwise. This guy, I like it already. They use only three numbers. Okay. So let's study this guy. So now our Lie algebra become epsilon IBC. And I hope you have seen in Aggie's class. This thing is called angular momentum. Sometimes they use I for some reason. But let me try to make the connection, use IJK as well. Okay, so this is what we're gonna study today and this afternoon. Then we can move on to something more complex. Okay, so there are two approaches. One approach is, I have Mathematica, so I can write a program. Let me just do exhaustive search. I'll find three matrices following that commutator relationship. Then I'll tell Mathematica, please increase your dimension by one and do it again. It's called a numerical method. It definitely would work. But, well, the idea is SU2 is our only hope. So hopefully it's going to help us somehow. So the first thing is we need a general recipe such that we can generalize. It's like when we have O3, we say that's just rotation in our three-dimensional that we can visualize. But then we kind of generalize. This is the same deal. We need to find something we are able to generalize. Hence, we talk about the general recipe. Okay, so we're going to follow these steps. Step one, we're gonna find the maximum set of mutually commuting generators. So basically, we want to find a bunch of generators such that we have, say, Ti, Tj equals 0 for any Ti, Tj belongs to this subset. Okay. This set has a fancy name called Cartan subalgebra because Cartan did the important work in this. Okay. For us, today though, it's nice. For J1, J2, J3, how many of them are mutually commuting? None of them. Well, that means we can at least pick one. It commutes with itself. Okay, very good. So for us, for SU2, let's just cherry pick J3. Because that's quantum mechanics pick. You can totally pick a J1, J2 and reproduce all the results. But let's just pick J3. And then, since I have only one, the number of these generators that generate this subalgebra is known as the rank. So for us, rank equals 1. So you might have heard SU2 is also known as A1. No idea where the A comes from. Maybe just the first algebra we discovered. But the 1 has a meaning. It means we have only one mutually commuting generator. And tomorrow, we're going to move to rank equals 2. Then we can take it to be infinity. That's the physicist approach, right? You study 1, 2, then you can just take a larger n. That's what we're going to do tomorrow. But let's focus on rank 1. Then we're done with step 1, we find new. Step 2. Step 2 is, well, we have all the other generators. What do I do with them? We're going to do linear combination of them. Such that they are, OK, blank. let me define something first. So I'm going to define the following operation. For each of this Katan subalgebra generators, I can define the following operation called J3 dot operating on something. We do the commutator, the operation called do the commutator. As hopefully we have seen, commutator is very important for us. And hopefully it equals to a constant times this dot. And this dot is what we are looking for. So remember, what we mean by multiplication is really a binary operation. So I can call this a multiplication. So I hope this reminds you of A times x equals lambda x. So now I can finish my sentence. We want to find the linear combinations of them such that they are eigenvectors. Of this subalgebra. Cartan generators. Okay. And this is turns out to be very helpful, as we will soon see. Okay. Then we're basically done. Then we'll move to step three. Step three says, as long as you choose this Katan subalgebra, well, as the definition implicates they mutually commuting each other, which in linear algebra we call it, we can simultaneously diagonalize. Okay, so the third step is really let's build our representation. The third step says, step three says, let's build a vector space. And find the matrix element, which is what we meant by representation. And there is a peculiar way to do it. It's called the highest weight method. And the weight is just a fancy name of those eigenvalues. Remember, there is an eigenvalue question over here. So these constants are referred as the weight, as we will see in SU2, that we start with the highest weight, we'll be able to find a vector space, find the matrix element, and then you are going to write a mathematical problem. Okay, that's an optional problem, but you can use it to write a program to produce, basically the computer will be like, which spin would you like? You input a spin, and then spits out three matrices, and then it follows that I, epsilon, ABC algebra. Okay, so now let's follow our step. We have already done step one. Very good. We only have two thirds to go. Let us do step two, which I hope that you have seen it already. Is that what we want is we're going to take some j, which is j1 plus aj2, and we demand this guy has the following commutator relationship with j3. You have seen this before, right? This is the fabled raising and lowering operator. Okay. It's definitely not a hard task. If you haven't seen it, you can just do it by yourself, just by plug it in. And we have those standard commutator. The result, A equals I. And the physicists like to put a 1 over square root 2 in front of it. It's just a normalization. Okay. So, right. And as we see, of course, Daniel pointed out, if we do that, our structure constants are going to change. So we have complete step two already. We're two-thirds done. But let's just complete this step, try to find what's the commutator of this new two generator we built for this nice convention, this guy equals J3. So the only thing we do is we find some linear combination, and we find this raising and lowering operator, which of course we need to explain why they are called raising and the lowering operator. Okay. So, but let's move to step three already, and we'll be done. Step three says we shall find a vector space, and you probably learned in quantum mechanics, we can choose this vector space to be the eigenvector space for J3. So let's build our vector space. Let's choose J3's eigenvector space such that the eigenvalue of J3 is m. And we demand, let's make our metric look nice. Orthonormal basis is always good. Okay, so of course we wonder, the first question we ask is why we call in those things raising and lowering operators. The reason follows. So suppose I have a state m, I wonder what's J plus acting on. Oh, by the way, you think this plus minus is the plus minus in front of I. No, this plus is its weight. Because the eigenvalue of J plus under that multiplication is plus 1. Because we have J3, J plus minus equals plus minus J plus minus. So this plus is the weight. Make a note of this, because in tomorrow, we're always going to do this. So if we make some generators of the original generator, we'll always have a subscript, which is the weight. Okay. So now let's say what happened. Well, we just have a commutator, right? So we can totally write this as J3 commutator with J plus, plus the result, well, the other way around, so which is J plus J3 acting on M. So this is really just expanding this commutator. And this guy says it's plus J plus. And this guy, it's J plus M, because we chose the eigenspace of J3. And of course, this is really just plus 1 plus M, J plus M. So this is what I mean. If we act J plus on this vector M, we ask, what's your eigenvalue under J3 then? Well, it's m plus 1. And so, it's not hard to convince ourselves if we just change that to be minus. It'll become m minus 1. So this is what we mean by raising and lowering. So we start with a state m. Start with a state m. If we act the J3 on it, it goes back to itself. Some multiplication. Okay, then if I act on J plus, I move to the new vector. If I act J minus, I go to something lower operator. So raising and lowering. And then we can raise it back again. This is what we meant by letter operators. And now, well, let's try to be happy, consent ourselves with a finite representation. So we hope this thing is not infinite. So we hope this thing terminates somewhere. Somewhere along the road, I find the highest weight. And we say, well, then we're done. You act J plus on it, we get a 0. So that's what I mean, highest weight. We want to raise more. how do we end up with zero? So this is how we define our highest weight, which is J plus G equals zero. Okay, so this turned out to be enough. So let's now try to find our matrix element. By finding our matrix element, I meant, so what I have shown you is that if I'm lowering this state, I'm going to get m minus 1 with some normalization constant I couldn't determine by that equation. The only thing I know is it's going to be state m minus 1. But what's in front of it, we don't know. But this is what we're looking for. So this tells you the matrix element, matrix subscript, the matrix representation of G minus is exactly, this is what we're after. Right? This is what we're after. We're after this matrix element. And this normalization constant is really what we need. Okay. So it's not hard to convince yourself that if you add J plus onto M minus 1, you will get this guy back. So this is really, write this as the matrix element. OK, I can just write it. This one says this equals NM. And then just take the adjoint of this. Then you get this. Because remember, it's plus minus I. So we have the nice relationship is these two things are actually adjoint of each other. Okay. And we also say this is not a unitary anymore. Okay. But let's see, how do we determine nm? As soon as we figure this out, we are done. We're completely done with this algebra. So the next thing we're going to do is to find a recursion relation. To do that, I'm going to study the following thing. I'm going to study M, J plus, J minus, M. This is a fine thing to study. And this, on one hand, this is very simple to study. This is really what I define to be NM. And this is the adjoint of this. So this is an M square. Okay. Clear? You should have seen this at some point. So, but on the other hand, we have nice commutator relationship, especially when we chose the physics convention. This thing itself is different. Okay, so we're doing the same trick as we find out. So when we find why it's called a raising lowering operator, we use the same trick. Then we're just using the same trick again. Okay, this guy will just give me J3. And this guy will give me J minus J plus M. Okay, this is just M because we know that the J3 is diagonal. And this guy, according to our definition, J plus, this is not a definition, this is just the adjoint of that guy. So according to this definition, we find out that J plus acting on M must give us a NM plus 1. And since this guy is just the adjoint of this, so this will give me N squared M plus 1. So this is the recursion relationship that we see sometimes. And now we just need to solve it. There are also two approaches to this. You can turn on Mathematica, says, Mathematica, I'll solve this. Mathematica will spit out the answer. But for this guy, we can actually solve it by ourselves. First of all, let's make an observation. Remember, we demand J plus acting the highest with J equals zero. So if you compare that, we already know N J plus 1 equals 0. Even Mathematica need an initial condition. So we start with there. And now, what do we do is just, let's start our, okay, let me change your board. Let's start our recursion relationship with the highest weight. So, we're going to start from n squared j equals j plus n squared j plus 1. It's a recursion relationship. So what do you think we're going to do? N squared j minus 1 equals j minus 1 plus n squared j, right? Then we'll just continue doing this. Then we write n squared m is n squared m plus 1. So this is what we mean by recursion relationship. We satisfy all these things as long as we know one thing, then we know all of them. And now let's add these things up. By add, let me add. Okay. So this guy is 0 by our initial condition. And this guy cancels. This guy canceled something there. So this guy canceled from something above. So what we're left is really only n squared m is nothing. Everything disappeared except this rows of numbers. J plus J minus 1 all the way down to m. We know how to do this. I think Gauss teaches us how to do this when he was 6 or something. It's crazy. But we know we just add them, divide by 2, multiply how many numbers we get, right? Okay, so now we truly achieve happiness because we find our matrix element is given by this formula. It says, what do we define? We define J minus acting on M. Now we know exactly what we mean. The even the constant. So this guy equals the square root of the thing we just calculated. Okay. Well, there are some comments need to be made. As we see, when we chose our m to be j plus 1, hey, you can't choose higher than the highest weight. Exactly. We get m equals 0. But if we stare at this square root thing, it seems if the first bracket equals 0, that is when m equals j plus 1, 0. But it seems to tell me that m equals minus j also equals 0. That means j minus acting on minus j also gave me 0. So I find this very, very enlightening. So we want to find the representation, but we want to make as few assumptions as possible. So I already assume a highest weight. And then the lowest weight just pop out. This guy got to be the lowest weight because you can't go lower. Huh. That's good. Remember, we are on a ladder, so we go from J to J minus 1 to go to J minus 2 to go to... Then they say this one has the end, goes to minus J. So that's 2-day steps. Hence, we recover the fabled result says spin can only to be half integer because we can't take non-integer steps. And then, of course, that just means J can be, well, 0, 1 half, 1, 3 halves, etc., etc. And in this scenario, we have 2J plus 1 states. Okay. So, this is basically what we meant by finding all the irreps of SU2. We did it. So then, in quantum mechanics, you will actually denote the state with J, M, where this guy is now known as the highest weight. And M, now we figure out, is between minus J to J and with a step. Okay, let me write one more number to indicate the step is integer. So, for example, there is a state called 3 halves, 1 half. So now we can really ask the question, what's M, the matrix element of J plus in the spin J representation? Well, we know this. We just write down the normalization thing. So the J plus acting on M prime will give us N M prime plus 1 M M prime plus 1. So this guy is N M prime plus 1 delta M M prime. Ah, we found all the matrix elements since M can be anything as long as it's allowed. And of course, you can just take the adjoint of this to find J minus. And you see, I'm more interested in J1, J2. No problem, they're linear combinations. Just go back to find your J1, J2. So, we accomplish our goal. We find all the irreps of SU2. So let me make a few comments here. One thing. This thing, matrix, is labeled by the funny M prime. So when you actually write down 2x2 matrix, so we have this funny notation. This is called a row minus a half. This is called a half. This is called a column minus half and a column a half. So we name our row and the columns with this M, which funnily could be half integers and not starting from 1. But of course, you can tell Mathematica to rescale it back to 1, 2, 3, 4 that she can understand. Okay, that's funny details for this afternoon. But let me make a few comments. Since the first few representation of SU2 are particularly interesting. So let's look at J equals 1 half, which have two states. And you would, in the future, learn in standard model that our quarks live in the twos. Our left-handed leptons live in twos of the SU2 of the standard model. So this thing is important. Hence, well, also, 2 is a very important number. So this 2 and this 2, remember this is called SU2. It's the same 2. So then we call this, when this happens, we call it the fundamental representation. And I just, as I mentioned, a lot of our fermions live here. Patient. Okay. So we call it a fundamental representation if the dimension M equals the row number of the defining matrix. So remember, there is always a defining matrix for SUN. It's the UU dagger equals 1, which has subscript n by n. So whenever you find a representation has M equals N, then we find SUN's fundamental representation. And we're going to find that tomorrow for SU3. Now we're going to see 3 in the 3 bar. Okay, let's move to the next guy. It has 3 states. Huh, why is that interesting? I don't know, 3 is also a very important number. I studied my 1, 2, 3s very carefully. So I have the following observation. 3 happens to equals to 2 square minus 1. And I hope that you have reviewed the first lecture. I said there were 2 important formulas. One of the important formulas is the number of generators of SUN is given by n squared minus 1. I also emphasize it as a QFT2 interview question. Or maybe even, well, standard model doesn't have it. Okay, QFT2. Then we'll ask that. I'll try to make sure. But anyway, this is a very interesting observation. Is we realize, wait a second, my 3 states, M, is equals to my number of generators. This seems to be something we discussed for the first half of the class, which we called the adjoint representation. And then, of course, you want to quickly ask the question. If I build my adjoint representation here, if you look at this matrix element, well, for example, G3 is diagonal. But I know that if I build it with the structure constant, it shouldn't be diagonal. You're like, huh? Well, in the tutorial, you're going to find it. They are related by similarity transformation. So they're equivalent. Good. We found, rediscovered our adjoint representation in this highest weight method. And the adjoint representation is also very interesting. If you have heard of the good old days ISO spin group, our pi mesons live in this adjoint representation, known as the force mediators for the force between the quarks. Also, our gluons also live in this adjoint representation of SU3 when n is 3 squared minus 1 equals 8. So we have 8 gluons. And beyond this, well, it's up to your own interest. I'll see you in the tutorial. And we'll study everything about SU2.